Does chilling people out help them when they have a heart attack in the hospital?
Guillain-Barré associated with the Zika virus.
What are the dangers of medicines for attention deficit disorder?
And life expectancy after heart attack related or not related to hospital performance.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on October 7th, 2016. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
And Rick, I pulled a U when I said, does chilling people out help them survive heart attacks? Not really a very funny subject, but I had to pull the pun at least for this week. For a study in the Journal of the American Medical Association, a look at whether hypothermia, a strategy to actually reduce body temperature, improves outcomes after myocardial infarction.
Well, I was amused by how you introduced it. As you alluded to, this is talking about a technique that's used in people that have cardiac arrest, mostly in people that have an out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, where therapeutic hypothermia, that is cooling people down, helps to improve their neurologic recovery and helps to improve their overall survival. What's not been known, however, is whether those same benefits extend to people that have an in-hospital cardiac arrest. So to address that, these investigators looked at over 26,000 individuals who were in a registry that had suffered an in-hospital cardiac arrest, and about 6% of them were treated with therapeutic hypothermia. They were cooled down. From that group that weren't cooled down, they chose twice as many patients to compare as those that were cooled down, and they were able to match them. So they were the same age and the same conditions. And what they discovered was that as opposed to out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, those that were in hospital actually had a worse outcome, a 12% lower risk of survival and a 21% lower risk of having a favorable neurologic outcome.
This is a very interesting thing, isn't it? Because, gosh, it seems somewhat inexplicable. What would the mechanism of hypothermia being beneficial outside of the hospital be compared to what happens inside the hospital?
So let's think about what happens out of hospital. When someone has a cardiac arrest, it oftentimes takes several minutes before CPR is administered and a longer period of time before emergency medical services individuals arrive and they get to the hospital. And during that time, they generate a lot of toxic reactive oxygen species.
Or free radicals.
And it's thought that the hypothermia, the cooling down, helps to prevent the generation of those free radicals. In hospital, CPR is usually applied very quickly, in less than a minute. Advanced cardiac life support is usually applied within minutes as well. So in these particular circumstances, cooling may not have the beneficial effect as it does outside the hospital.
So this is good news because it's one less thing that will be attempted when we're trying to get somebody resuscitated in the hospital.
Absolutely. We don't want to be doing things that are futile. And this is one of those things that doesn't appear to be helpful. In fact, worsens the outcome.
Since we're talking about the heart then, let's turn to the New England Journal of Medicine. A study, I thought, a big study that came to some very interesting conclusions with regard to survival relative to the same issue, a heart attack, in high-performing hospitals versus those that aren't so high-performing.
It goes without saying, if you are described as a high-performing hospital, you think that the outcomes are better. And in fact, there's a lot of public reporting now around how hospitals do. And the typical measure they use is 30-day outcome or 30-day survival. So you can go online now and you can look at a hospital and say, when people present with a heart attack, what is the 30-day survival? And high-performing hospitals show that the 30-day survival rate's better than a low-performing hospital. But the real question is, does that translate into longer survival? So what Harlan Krumholz from Yale did with his colleagues is they analyzed data from what's called the Cooperative Cardiovascular Project. This is a group of Medicare patients that were hospitalized between 1994 and 96 with MI, or heart attack, and now we have 17 years of follow-up. And they looked at high-performing and low-performing hospitals. And what they discovered was in almost 120,000 patients that had a heart attack admitted to over 1,800 different hospitals, the survival benefit at 30 days lasted as long as 17 years. The mortality or survival differed between high and low performing hospitals in the first 30 days, but they maintain that benefit over the next 17 years. What that means is if you were admitted to a high performing hospital, you are on average likely to live somewhere between 3/4 of a year and over 1 year longer over the long term than those who were admitted to a low performing hospital.
clearly this is very persuasive with regard to the establishment of regional centers to which people who suffer an MI are transported immediately. At least that would be my interpretation. What's your interpretation regarding, well, what's the difference here?
I think you're right. This gives credence to the fact that high-performing hospitals have a long-term benefit, even among the range of patients. There are some that are more sick than others. But this long-term benefit accrued across all the range. We need to set the bar and identify why those lower-performing hospitals are, in fact, in that range. And we need to correct those things.
Okay. Let's turn, staying in the New England Journal of Medicine, to something that we haven't talked about for a few weeks. That's the Zika virus phenomenon taking place worldwide. In this case, clear evidence that there is a relationship between Zika infection and the development of the neurological condition called Guillain-Barré.
Most of the focus on the Zika virus has been with regard to birth defects or microcephaly. But when there's been an outbreak of Zika virus, for example, as was in French Polynesia several years ago, or more recently in Colombia, they noticed there was an uptick in the cases of Guillain-Barré. And that's an ascending paralysis. Individuals begin to develop weakness in the legs, can progress all the way up to the entire body. And many of these people end up in the intensive care unit, and many of them on a ventilator. What these investigators tried to do was to nail it down more specifically. During the time of an increased outbreak in the country of Colombia, they identified 68 individuals that had Guillain-Barré. They did a number of tests and looked at the historical features, and what they discovered was, on average, these individuals developed Guillain-Barré about 7 days after the onset of the virus, viral symptoms, things like fever and muscle aches. So an average of a week, but as short as 3 days to as long as 10 days. About 80% of these people had the ascending paralysis, about 3/4 of them had paresthesias, unusual feelings, and half of them had bilateral facial paralysis as well. To make the diagnosis, usually was done with a urine test. Fortunately, few individuals died as a result of it, only 4%. But a third of them were on a ventilator, and almost 2/3 were in the intensive care unit. So this nails down pretty conclusively that there is an association between Guillain-Barré and Zika viral infections.
Outside of the fact that we clearly need an effective vaccine for Zika, what else could we do to interrupt this development of this condition, which sometimes has long-term sequela?
Absolutely. There's not much we can do to prevent this other than preventing the infection. I want people to be aware of it. It does have some treatment implications. Usually people receive an intravenous infusion of immunoglobulins, and so that needs to be initiated.
Part of the ongoing story, and something that I reflect on thinking to myself, wow, clearly this virus did not arise de novo. It's been around for a while, and I sure wish I knew what the multitude of factors are that have brought it so prominently to everyone's attention all over the world. Finally, then, let's turn to something else that's a really big public health problem in my mind. In JAMA Pediatrics, a look at mineral density in children's bones in those children who are taking medicines for attention deficit disorder.
Elizabeth, I'm glad you picked this particular article because this was news to me, and I think it's important to our listeners as well, since there are over 6 million children in the United States that have attention deficit or hyperactivity disorder, what's called ADHD. And the primary treatment is to give stimulants. What I was unaware of is that in the animal models, when you do that, it actually causes a decrease in bone density and predisposes animals to osteoporosis. Why is that important? Because in children, they're laying down new bone, and if that's prevented, it predisposes them to osteoporosis and to fracture. In kids that receive amphetamine-like medications, does it affect their bone density? So the investigators used data collected from the NHANES, the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey database, so they could find out whether the kids had ADHD and what medications, and then many of these kids had DEXA scans looking at the bone density. And what they discovered was the individuals with ADHD who were taking stimulants, it decreased their bone mineral density by about 5 to 10%. And that was true in the spine, the femur, and in the femoral neck as well, where fractures are most likely to occur. Surprising information that stimulant use leads to decreased bone mineral density. And by the way, in particular, this was children that had been treated for 3 months or longer.
I'm really concerned about this because there's all sorts of factors that could exacerbate this problem. For example, as we know, children are a good deal less active, physically active, than they used to be. We know that bone takes on more mineral density when there's weight-bearing exercise. So I'm wondering just how at risk some of these people are going to be as they age.
And the other factor that we didn't talk about is the fact that cigarette smoking also decreases bone mineral density. So if someone's smoking, if they're not exercising very much, and they're on a stimulant as well, all three of those factors can decrease bone mineral density and predispose kids to osteoporosis and to fractures in the future.
And clearly, we know nothing about whether calcium supplementation would be beneficial in this group.
Yep, so this is the first study. It doesn't establish a causal relationship, but certainly suggests an association between these two.
Okay. So this week on the blog, I'm going to give kudos to our home team, of course, with the study on Zika and Guillain-Barré in the New England Journal of Medicine. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.